This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're joined by one of the people who worked to get Amendment 4 to the Florida Constitution on the midterm election ballot. It passed with support from more than two-thirds of Florida voters and officially takes effect today. Supporters say it was written to be self-executing, meaning without any input or direction from the state legislature. But some lawmakers and Governor-elect Ron DeSantis do not agree. We'll sit down with one of the people who got the amendment on the ballot to find out how Amendment 4 Implementation Day is going. But first, there's a new PBS documentary premiering next week that tells the story of man's desire to drain what was considered to be the swamp of the Florida Everglades in order to make the land suitable for human use, all without really understanding or even considering the potential consequences. The film follows the effort, which began in the late 1800s and continued in earnest through the middle of the next century, resulting in large-scale ecological damage. Man's efforts modified water flows, and that is causing us major environmental problems to this very day. The Swamp, Nature Never Surrenders, is an American experience film. It's based in part on the 2007 book called The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise by journalist Michael Grunwald, who joins us by phone today. Michael, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks so much for having me.
I know that you're in an airport, so I will cut you. Cut you free very soon, but I do appreciate you making the time to talk with us. We're also joined in the studio today by two environmental scientists to help us connect the story told in this documentary to the environmental consequences that we are feeling today. Dr. Serge Thomas is an associate professor for environmental studies at Florida Gulf Coast University. Dr. Thomas, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you to have me.
Good to see you again. And also, we are joined by Dr. Eric Milbrandt. He is the Marine Laboratory Director at the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. Dr. Milbrandt, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Michael Grunwald, I have to say, I bought your book back when I first moved to Florida, and it's something that has really helped to inform my perception of this state. I want to know what made you want to write that.
Oh, thanks so much for your kind words. First of all, would that everybody felt like you did. I wrote it, I was at the time, back when I was young and single and childless, I was a reporter at the Washington Post, and I got obsessed with the Army Corps of Engineers, which was ultimately sort of in charge of destroying the Everglades back when wetlands were considered wastelands, and then now are in charge of the largest environmental project in the history of the planet to try to restore the Everglades. So that's what sort of first attracted me to the story. And then once I kind of got into the archives and started reading about Florida history, I realized that the story of man and nature in southern Florida is really, it's the story of Florida, which pretty much all used to be a swamp, and it's really a much larger story about man and nature on Earth.
Yep.
So
an epic battle.
That's a long story of how I got obsessed with this kind of crazy swamp I had never visited before the year 2000.
So in 2007 is when the book came out?
2006.
Since 2006, there's been a bit that has changed. How do you feel things are coming along since you put the book out into the world?
Well, not so well. This at the time it was an $8 billion restoration project. Now it's up to about $16 or $20 billion. It's a very complicated project, but it's essentially a water storage project. The idea is to store more of the water that used to sit on the Everglades all year long and is now dumped out to sea, and instead so that you'd have it all year long in the dry season instead of having these droughts. But instead we have the droughts are much worse, the floods are much worse, and that you've seen in the last couple of years that this water, excess water, has been blasted into the estuaries. You see this horrible guacamole glop that's shrouded the East Coast. You have these terrible red tides that are killing dolphins and manatees on the West Coast. And they haven't yet built, in the last 18 years, they haven't built any water storage. So you still have 69 endangered species in the Everglades. You still have this national and international treasure that just isn't working because the water's all messed up and we haven't fixed it.
And we also got a lot of that guacamole gunk over here this year, too, on our coast as well. So, do you find that
people... Yeah, welcome.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to the guacamole party. It's great. That was sarcastic, obviously. So I want to know, do you feel like people are looking into history maybe to try to unravel some of the serious problems that we created for ourselves? And then when we do look back, do you feel like we're heeding those lessons from the past?
Well, I hope so. I mean, what we're really seeing is 100 years of history. The kind of the bill is coming due, right? It's being dumped on you on the West Coast. It's being dumped on me on the East Coast. You saw we have things like the 1928 hurricane where, you know, that was back when, right, the beginning of, oh, you want to buy some Florida swamp land. People started buying it and moving to the Everglades that, of course, wasn't yet drained. And you have this horrible hurricane that kills 2,000 people who had moved into the swamp by these false promises of drainage. I like to say that we're still cleaning up from that hurricane. Because when you have that guacamole, essentially the reason they're blasting all that water out of Lake Okeechobee to the east and the west is so that you don't have another disaster now that we have 10 million people living in South Florida. So really, I mean, the lessons of the past are really the lessons of today. You know, back when we thought that the answer to these wetlands was to improve them, to reclaim them, to try to create America's winter garden, now we've realized that the Everglades is special, not only because it's beautiful and this important ecological treasure, but because our drinking water sits underneath the Everglades. Because, you know, really this is the test of whether we're going to be able to kind of fix man's ecological mistakes. So there's really a lot riding on whether we can get this ecosystem right.
So when you're watching this film and when reading this book, it's kind of easy from today's perspective to look down our collective noses at the hubris with which mankind thought that it could alter nature. But back in the late 1800s, you know, science wasn't what it is today. I mean, it was in 1871 that Darwin published his Descent of Man. And that was controversial because it presented man as an ordinary part of nature instead of something special. And in the documentary, you talked about people believing that they were doing God's work. But at the time, man's place in nature was kind of perceived as very different from how we would define it today. So I guess my question would be, when did people start to see nature as an ecosystem with this interdependence and the wide-reaching cause and effect?
No, that's right. I mean, look, Florida was a backwater. I mean, back in the 1880s, 1890s, when there were already a million people living in New York City, the entire population of southern Florida was in the 200s. It really was seen as this kind of ecological disaster, this place that you couldn't be because there was too much water. And, of course, the history of the next 70, 80 years was just man's failed attempts to drain the swamp, which, of course, as we know today, that's what people use that phrase to mean, kind of to get rid of something nasty. It was really only in the 60s and the 70s, with the sort of Earth Day revolution, when people started to recognize that, you know, the water we drink, the air we breathe, the wetlands that store our floodwaters and filter our drinking water, that the landscapes that we like to look at and enjoy, that it's kind of good for us as well as the bugs and bunnies. And that was really the beginning of this kind of slow process of at least coming to the realization that we've got to do something. I guess the next process will be actually trying to do it correctly.
And I know there are always people who see a movie and want to say they like the book better, but there was part of the book that I really loved, and I didn't see it in the documentary. But it was mainly the beginning, when there was the entire debate of whether to even fight for Florida. And the accounts of the soldiers who had to go into the Everglades and try to fight with an enemy that understood the land so much better. I found that to be a really interesting part of your book. And I wonder if you could kind of, you know, encapsulate it a little bit for some of our listeners.
I mean, sure. Back when there was really nobody living down in southern Florida, that was the time of the Seminole Wars. And of course, one of the ironies of South Florida, we always talk about how everybody here is from somewhere else. Even our native peoples, our indigenous peoples, weren't from South Florida. They were driven there. They were living in Alabama, and the United States was fighting this war of extermination. And essentially, they took refuge in the swamp. And the U.S. Army came down chasing them to try to exterminate the Seminoles. And what they found was this awful mosquito-infested, place that, as the first U.S. government report on the Everglades described it, They said it was suitable only for the resort of pestilential vermin or noxious reptiles. I mean, they really thought, gosh, why are we even fighting for it? We should give this place to the Indians. But what they did recognize is, man, the weather's really nice. The soil looks pretty good. If we could just get rid of all this water, we'd have something fantastic. And that was really the next, the next 70, 80 years of Florida history was this often futile effort to get rid of all this water that just piled up on these flatlands of southern Florida. Ultimately, we've done it. So now, we call alligator control or animal control 18,000 times a year because there are alligators in our backyard. What we don't really recognize is that we've moved into the alligator's backyard, and it's because of this modern water control system that's gotten rid of all this water so that essentially we can have 10 million people and 400,000 acres of sugar fields and God knows how many, Taco Bells and Jiffy Lubes and Sawgrass Expressways and Palmetto Expressways where the Sawgrass and Palmettos used to be.
Yeah, exactly. Named for what once was there. Do you feel kind of like this documentary really captures the main points of history from your book?
Definitely. I think they did a really nice job. I mean, of course, they're talking, it's only a part of the book. I mean, the documentary is really about draining the swamp. My book is sort of about the swamp, draining the swamp, successfully draining the swamp and then trying to fix the swamp. But I think what they really capture is this sense of Florida as the last frontier, right? I mean, we think of Alaska or the Wild West. But really Florida, there was this, 6 years after the famous historian Frederick Jackson Turner declared that the Western frontier was closed. There was a guy went through the Everglades and was really like a Lewis and Clark journey of exploration. This was really this backwater, and now it's become this kind of spectacular megalopolis with, politics and culture and people and more people and more people, where we have this Ponzi scheme where we bring in 1,000 people a day who are really their livelihood depends on bringing in 1,000 more people tomorrow. We've created this really bizarre, incredible civilization in a place that for most of human history, humans thought was uninhabitable.
Yeah,
and I think they do a really great job of getting across the way that, first, just the formidable nature of this ecosystem, and then the way human beings started to write their dreams onto this blank landscape where you had this incredible land boom, the selling land by the gallon, right?
That was funny, yeah.
That famous scene from Coconuts where Groucho Marx says, you can even get stucco. Oh, boy, can you get stucco?
Yeah.
And this really gives a sense of how crazy things were down here.
Yeah, it's really an interesting documentary in your book also. I mean, there's always so much more in the book. So I do want to tell you that
well, hopefully everybody will buy that too,
Michael Gorman, I know that you're in an airport and I don't want to take too much of your time, but thank you so much for being part of Gulf Coast Live with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Julie. Thank you.
Have a safe flight. If you're just joining the show today, that was Michael Grunwald. He is the author of the book The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise, which is the basis for a new PBS documentary that premieres a week from today. These days, Grunwald is a senior national correspondent for Time magazine. Now we're going to turn to two local scientists to talk about the current day situation with the Everglades and its impact on Southwest Florida. Dr. Serge Thomas is an associate professor for environmental studies here at FGCU, and Dr. Eric Milbrandt is a marine laboratory director at the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Milbrandt. One of the first questions I asked of Mr. Grunwald is the one of perspective. Looking at the past with what we know now is kind of a fool's exercise. So when exactly did scientists start to put together the interconnectedness of nature into what we now call ecosystems? When did that become a piece of scientific jargon?
So when Rachel Carson published her book Silent Spring in the early 1960s, I think that was the birth of the modern field of ecology where you have interconnectedness among multiple levels of the food chain and also within water being connected through groundwater to people and people's drinking water. So that was a really important moment, and it really started the whole field of ecology as a quantitative scientific discipline.
World's worst pun. I'm saying a watershed moment. No. So can you tell me a little bit about the current condition of the Everglades ecosystem? Is it terrible right now?
So the current system is it took us 100 years to try and drain it to this modern system that we have now with flood control. So we're into about the 20th year of the Everglades, Central Everglades Restoration Plan. And that plan was laid out to provide more storage and to provide better timing and delivery of water to the Everglades, which is now currently starved of water because the infrastructure is not in place to be able to store the water and deliver it in a timely way. So what happens is when lake levels are high and rainfall predictions and the climate is ready to dump more rain or a hurricane, all that excess water comes out through the S79 reservoir and also to the East Coast. And we are inundated with high flows in the summer months typically. That lasts into a lot of times our drier months of the year. So I would say the system right now is providing some fresh water, but the timing is way off and it's not – It's degrading the estuary.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Thomas, I'm going to ask you, is it possible at all to even characterize how different it is today compared to before humans, or I would say Europeans came, not native, but when people tried to start messing with the water flows? Is there any way to compare before to now?
I think there is a pretty obvious comparison. It's not comparable.
Incomparable.
Incomparable. Yeah, because it's a very highly compartmentalized system with a series of ditches and canals and the water is really definitely not right. The timing is not right. You got impoundment like in water conservation areas, and then you got places where the water really dry, flows very quickly, like on the east side and the west side of Lake Okeechobee. And then it has a very drastic impact on the Everglades. Just if you look at Google Earth, people love Google Earth, and you look at the shape of the tree islands in water conservation area, you will see that they actually are round in shape. And the reason they're round is because you're lacking the flow. If you look in the Everglades National Park, those tree islands actually have a teardrop shape because there is flow that actually is moving through those islands. And you can see.
They should be teardrop shaped, but they've become round because the flow is too dramatic absent?
Because it's absent. Because it's basically there is stagnating water. Yeah. And as well, you can look also at the water level. The water level is way too high in a water conservation area compared to in the Everglades.
The rest of it.
Yeah.
What does it mean then for things to be dry? The soil composition different, off? How bad is it for the Everglades for it to be dry?
Well, that affects a lot of what we call the biogeochemistry. So it means in layman's terms, soil, bacteria, and chemistry. So for example, when the peat, which is mainly organic, is
is it like rotting leaves and stuff that you find at the bottom of the water?
Okay. Exactly. It's black, soil, and it's very fertile, but it also oxidizes very quickly. So basically that thing oxidizes and you're losing the peat over time. In other region, when it's getting too much water, then you actually have way too much peat, accretion in those regions. So you have this aspect, and then you also have the plants and the algae. There is especially a special component, attached algae, in the Everglades, and those are very key components for the food chain. And if they get too dry, then you're missing a big portion of the food that cannot actually funnel up to the top of the food chain.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting when I was watching the documentary, I got to do a sneak peek. They talked about the wildfires, and what I found really interesting, it wasn't just dry vegetation that was burning. They said the actual soil is what is burning. How does that happen?
Well, the peat is mostly fibrous carbon, so it's a perfect fuel, like lean in your air dryer. It's like a lot of carbon, and when it's very dry, it just burned very quickly. So that can happen.
It kind of creeps me out to think about dirt burning.
Yeah, and the periphyton, which also made of algae, can also burn to some extent as well. Periphyton, which are the attached algae that live on the bottom, and when they get too dry, they get very crusty, like a crusty pie, and they can burn as well.
Yeah, I've had crusty pie. I'm not good at that. And so I want to ask both of you guys, do you think that this is something that can be reversed, and what is required to do that?
So the technology and the know-how is clearly there. What's needed now are places to build the reservoirs, which we have plans on the books to do through the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. These things are not getting any cheaper, though. The more that we delay as far as getting funding secured for projects or being able to acquire land, it will only be more expensive in the future. And that takes political will. The Everglades restoration is a 50-50 partnership between the state and the federal government. And so in certain times, the state is providing everything that's needed, and the federal government is arguing in Congress about funding projects in Florida when there's needs throughout the rest of the country, and vice versa. So
sometimes the federal government's ready to go, and then the state's not.
Right. So I think the technology and the engineering and the plans are there. It's political will, and people need to support the project as a restoration project.
So the reservoirs are required because you can't just take the water from Lake Okeechobee and put a big pipe down and just start shooting it down there.
So we have 10 million people in South Florida now, and what used to be a very large area, it's essentially the whole south part of the Florida Peninsula was covered, if you want to think about it this way, in 1 or 2 inches of water. Well, now that we have all these people, development, we have agriculture, all the water has been drained from the land, so it's no longer 2 inches of water over the entire south half of the state. Now we have canals and reservoirs, and then we have at the bottom half is the Everglades, which is still sheet flow, 1 or 2 inches of water over the entire landscape over a very large area. So we need large reservoirs to be able to, in the dry months, be able to supply water to the wetland for the ecosystem function. And then when it really rains, we need to be able to store that water and so that we can release it more slowly.
Have a more controlled release, right? Okay, I understand what you're saying. But the thing is, Dr. Thomas, we were talking a little bit last night about the cost analysis of this. And you were talking about the cost of causing the problem versus the cost of fixing the problem. Tell me a little bit about that. And then you also boil it all the way down to just the cost of phosphorus and phosphorus removal.
So in ecology, generally systems have mechanism that help them to react to changes. And generally, when a system changes, it changes very abruptly. So when the system has changed, and it has changed quite a bit, and the more we wait, the more it will change, and the more it will be difficult to restore it to what it used to be, and especially the cost. So if we're talking this in terms of energy, the cost to actually make it change the first time, if you want to reverse the situation and make it pristine again, you're going to have to spend more energy to actually make it the same as it was before. So that's called the hysteresis. And it's very common in pretty much all systems. You have a sudden change, and then when you want to change it back, you actually have to spend more dollars that originally you would need to just restore it.
I'm thinking about like when you stub your toe and you almost fall over. It doesn't take much to stub your toe and start to fall. But when you try to correct that fall and bring yourself back up, that's a lot more energy expense.
Yes.
To correct the problem once you've made it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were talking about phosphorus. And there's a big problem with the nutrients going out into this water. Tell me a little bit about that cost comparison.
Yeah. So I'm very, very shocked when I first saw the numbers. But basically, we're using a lot of phosphorus for many different things, and we're not closing the loop of nutrient, meaning we're not recycling the nutrient, whether it's phosphorus or nitrogen. And we keep on dumping more and more and more and more. One of the problems is that nutrient as fertilizer is very cheap. So, for example, for phosphorus, which is a main, most important nutrient in the freshwater Everglades, it costs about 30 cents per pound. All right. However, when you want to remove it from the system using, for example, constructed wetland, which are wetlands that we construct to remove and filter the water, you know, the cost actually increases from 30 cents to about $130 to $600 a pound.
$130 to $600 a pound to get the phosphorus out of water that you want to send.
Correct.
Because you can't just send phosphorus-laden water out into the Everglades either, because you were saying last night at the panel discussion we were a part of that it's kind of like putting too much fertilizer on your lawn. You're going to burn it.
Correct. In the Everglades, it's not really this. It's mainly the system changes. So the plants and the algae that are native and adapted to low phosphorus level
aren't going to be able to make it.
Will not be able to make it, and instead you're going to have the nasty algae and plants.
The blue-green stuff.
Blue-green eventually, or you can also have, especially on the wetlands, cattails, which are not favorable. You know, the stem with a hot dog on a stick, that's what I tell my student about. So those are not very, very good and indicator actually of high phosphorus levels.
Well, that's good to know.
Yes.
And so then that makes me want to turn now to the blue-green algae and the red tide. And Dr. Milbrandt, is there any scientifically proven correlation between the degradation of the Everglades and the blue-green algae and or red tide, which we know are two different things?
So the blue-green algae bloom that we had this summer, it was stretched from Cape Coral and South Fort Myers all the way up to Lake Okeechobee, where there was a bloom occurring during that time. And the nutrient the nutrients in Lake Okeechobee are very high. It is considered a polluted water body by the state of Florida. So there are plans to clean it up. But, you know, when the lake levels get too high, in order to protect all of those communities south of the lake, that water comes down the Coosahatchee, and it caused an algae bloom. Now, the blue-green algae bloom that was this year was much more expansive than it has been previously. In years past, it was present typically around the Franklin Lock and Dam structure, and it would accumulate when there was stagnant flows, when the temperatures were high and there was not a lot of flow. This year, as they were lowering the lake levels, the bloom really got started, and then it got really, really bad in Fort Myers, Cape Coral, and the canals. So the red tide bloom that occurred this year, it actually started in November of 2017 following large discharges, 90 days of excessive discharges because of Hurricane Irma. So that bloom persisted for a year, and then it really caused a major ecological damage during July. And there's really it's an active research area for many of us that are trying to understand the connectivity, if there is one, between the blue-green algae bloom and its dissipation and the ramping up of the red tide and the high concentration and widespread effects that it had.
What's interesting is laypersons who are not scientists want to easily make these correlations, and they look at the anecdotal evidence in front of them and say, well, obviously this is causing this. Do you find it difficult sometimes as a scientist to express to people that science has to have data and evidence to back up the claim that's being made, that this correlates with that and here's why?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with helping people understand that, for example, the red tide bloom is a saltwater. It originates in the Gulf of Mexico. We don't really know what starts it. We think that it is intensified and more widespread because of human activity and because of discharges from the coast. So I think explaining some of those things really helps people understand. But unfortunately, we don't have all the answers, and there's not a silver bullet.
Well, and scientists like to be sure before they come out and start saying things.
Right.
Because other scientists are going to look at you and say, where's your data?
Right.
And nobody likes to get called out like that. But have you seen anything in the way of movement when it comes to funding research into these things that correlates with the tenor of political speak? A lot of people have been screaming about it and very angry about it. I mean, for good reason. They want to know what's going on. Have you seen any funding come through that's going to help bolster the research to put finer points on some of these pieces of data?
So what I've seen is a real push for funding to clean up the blooms. That's not really the way to go about this problem. We need to start by preventing the blooms, by limiting the amount of nutrients that are in our water bodies. So I imagine that there'll be some initiatives and some funding for research in these areas of bloom formation in the next 3 or 4 years because of what happened.
We have a call coming in from Mark in North Fort Myers. He says he's a botanist and has 2 cents to contribute to the conversation. Mark, what would you like to share?
Oh, yes. Hi, Julie and everybody. Well, very quickly, personally, having lived here for 40-some years and studying the ecosystems and being in them, I think that the very idea of having the Army Corps of Engineers attempting to fix the problem that they originally created is sort of an exercise in insanity. You know, the concept of repeating the same experiment over again. And yeah. I think that's ridiculous, especially the idea of digging huge holes and putting contaminated groundwater down into the aquifers can only spell some kind of future further disaster. And I also wanted to just mention briefly that this whole destruction of South Florida has been going on for a very long time, as was evidenced by a book by the curator of the New York Botanic Garden. His name was John Small. It was written over 100 years ago. The book is titled Florida, from Eden to Sahara. It was going on that long ago.
Well, Mark, I really want to thank you for your comments. And he brings up one of the solutions that has been floated, which is the deep injection wells. Have you guys heard of those deep injection wells much? I don't know if has there been much study as far as what kind of impact that might have on the water table?
So deep injection wells are used for discharging wastewater that's treated, and in small volumes, it has been a proven technology, I would say. But as the caller mentioned, there's still so many unknowns about pumping water that may be fairly high, is fairly high in nutrients, especially at the volumes that are needed for the Everglades restoration, that it's experimental. So I think the approach on a large scale is something that we should watch and follow the technology as it is studied.
Yes, as a follow-up, I think one of the main concerns I have is that with those reservoirs is that you can have a reservoir and it's a good holding water tank, basically, and yet you basically use it to regulate the flow. To have their, you know, mimic the regular flow pattern. The problem is that if that water is loaded with nutrient, you might eventually have algae bloom also growing within
that
water.
I'm just thinking about a fish tank that you leave alone for too long.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, for example, yes. The problem is that if your nutrient pool is changing from nutrient to algae, then the algae get released with the water. You know, they're not attached to anything. That's why treatment wetlands are much better. Sure, you need more expensive land because it's shallower water. However, you're going to have the plants and the bacteria and the algae attached to the plant that will be cleaning the water, but the nutrient will stay within those treatment wetlands. It will not. The water will not actually take the nutrient with it as phytoplankton.
I understand what you're saying.
Small algae.
I followed that.
And to me, the best solution is to mimic what historical Everglades was, which is a shallow periphyton and wetland community. So, you know, as treatment wetlands is the best solution. Unfortunately, the amount of land that we're talking about, the entire south half of the state of Florida was once the Everglades. We're now limited in terms of who owns the land and how much land can be acquired by the state in order to create these treatment wetlands.
I'm sitting here envisioning inland seawalls to contain like where the inside part.
So currently south of Lake Okeechobee, that's where we have those stormwater treatment areas. We basically have 8% of the Everglades agriculture area, which is 700 acres, being SDAs. And we need about 20%. So currently we have 56,000 acres of SDAs, and we need an additional 100,000 acres of SDAs to, according to sources, to be able to clean the water that will basically flow south to the Everglades and especially Florida Bay that greatly need it.
So you need another 100,000
acres
to create that 1 to 2 inch level water level filtering kind of
to make sure we have enough water flowing south,
okay,
and no longer east and west.
Yeah. Okay. But we had a preview screening of this documentary last night out on Sanibel, and people were asking about water table levels, sea level rise, the hope that a restored Everglades might trap carbon. Spoiler alert. You said that's probably not going to be the best option for that. There were some really knowledgeable questions coming from this crowd. Are you surprised at the interest in education people have gotten on these topics?
I'm not surprised at all. I always say to my student, to get the water right, we need to get the people right, meaning they need to understand the system. They need to understand that the Everglades is valuable. It's not a swamp. A swamp is actually good. A marsh is actually good. You know, they actually are cleaning ecosystems for you, and they have very important ecological functions, you know, of values of wetland in the world in terms of water treatment is $3.8 billion, you know, $1 trillion, sorry. So a lot of value. And I think that our natural ecosystem is undervalued. And if people actually would see them as valuable in terms of recharging the aquifer, filtering the water, that would be a big leap forward.
Dr. Milbrandt, are you inspired a little bit by the public's sense of engagement in this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. I think on Sanibel Island, we are at the downstream, most downstream recipients of these flows from the Caloosahatchee and from Lake Okeechobee. And it's necessary that people understand the system has constraints and there are solutions available. And the more that they learn that the facts from the from non-facts then, you know, the more quickly we can move to a solution and restore maybe not the historic Everglades, but a more functional Everglades, given there's 10 million people in South Florida.
Exactly. It's an interesting topic, and there are a lot of people at the table trying to figure out how they can do the best thing. And I think we all kind of want the same end result, is for the Everglades to be healthy again. It's just a matter of the different perspectives on how to get us there. I want to thank you both for being here. That's all the time that we have for this part of the show. Dr. Serge Thomas, the Associate Professor for Environmental Studies at Florida Gulf Coast University, thanks so much for being here again.
You bet.
And also Dr. Eric Milbrandt, Marine Laboratory Director of the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
It was great talking to both of you again. And I also want to thank Michael Grunewald, who we spoke with earlier. He's the author of the book, The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise, and a senior national correspondent for Time magazine. The American Experience documentary called The Swamp, Nature Never Surrenders, premieres next Tuesday, January 15th at 9 p.m. on PBS stations everywhere, including WGCU. There will be a public screening of the film on Monday, January 14th at 5:30 p.m. at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. It's kind of a sneak preview. I'll be there for that one, too. You could check out our website, gulfcoastlive.org, for more details on that. When we return, we're sitting down with one of the people who were instrumental in the passage of Amendment 4 to the Florida Constitution during the last election, which takes effect today. And that means approximately 1.4 million ex-felons in Florida can register to vote. But how the process will work remains somewhat unclear. We'll get the latest. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.